Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event in conjunction with the Science and Technology Forum led by Chisako Russ. So we have tonight for our audience here in San Francisco and also our online and radio audiences a great talk set up by Professor Tony Barnosky on the tipping point for planet Earth. Tony is a professor of integrated biology at UC Berkeley. He is the author of Heat Stroke, and he has a book coming out in the spring called Power, Food, and Money. Do I have that right? Okay. It sounds like the next Bolshevik, pronunciation, to lead the masses. But obviously, the ideas behind what's going on the planet, and especially to do it scientifically about the demographics that are involved, absolutely crucial to the decisions that we make going forward. And I'm myself perfectly eager to find out whether there's any historical situation where humanity has looked forward and said that'd be a good idea and we all work together to make it happen. So, Professor Barnosky.
Well, thanks, everybody, for showing up. You know, it's cocktail time and it's dinner time and all that, so I'm very honored that you're actually here to listen to me instead. So tipping points. I would guess that most of you in this room, everybody have a cup of coffee or a cup of tea or something this morning? All right. So if you boiled your water, you saw a tipping point. All right. My mom always used to say to me, watch pot never boils, as I was fidgeting there nervously or whatever. And the reason a watch pot never seems to boil is because you're observing a threshold effect. So you watch it, nothing happens, but really something's happening. You've got a gradual heating up, and then it hits that boiling point. That's a threshold event or a critical transition in scientific terms, and it turns to steam. The bubbles start to roil, and so on. So that's the tipping point. And the characteristics of tipping points are you don't observe a lot of change, or maybe you observe some very gradual change for a long time. Then all of a sudden, all hell breaks loose, okay? In the case of water boiling, it turns to steam. Now, tipping points are really, really, really common in nature. They happen all the time at all different scales. Tonight, I really want to be thinking about a very big scale, the planetary scale. So let's think about tipping points at the planetary scale. My background is actually in paleontology, so tracing the evolution of life through long, long time periods. And, you know, what this little spiral diagram is showing you the geologic history of the Earth. So we start way back when 550 million years ago and roll it on up, and you might be able to see a lot of little lines dividing time here. Well, each one of those lines dividing time you can think of as a planetary tipping point. And the one that is nearest in time to us is this change from the Pleistocene, that's the ice ages when a lot of the Earth was actually covered by a mile or so of ice, into the Holocene, which is our present warm time. So humanity evolved during the Holocene, okay, the past 10,000 years. That was a tipping point. That change happened fairly rapidly. By fairly rapidly, I mean over about 1,000 years. I'm thinking like a geologist here, okay? But it's rapid in the context of prior to that time, Earth was locked in this major glaciation period for about 100,000 years. And if you think about the past 10,000 years, we've been in this fairly normal interglacial time. We go 100,000 years, the Earth is in one state, 1,000 years, change, and then now we're back in this other state. So that's a state change, okay? And the transition was pretty rapid. Now, what's going on today, and why we're talking about tipping points, is we're jumping from the Holocene into what a lot of people are now calling the Anthropocene, which is basically the time in Earth's history when people are driving the boat, okay? Another way to think about it is people, us, have become a geological force that is, in fact, greater, and I'll tell you why I say greater, greater than what caused us to go from a time in Earth's history when we're covered with a mile of ice in much of the northern hemisphere to the time when civilization evolved. So let's think about that a little bit. You know, a lot of times when people talk about tipping points and put up words like this, it's all gloom and doom, right? I hope I actually don't leave you with a total gloom and doom story tonight. Earth is a pretty good place right now. I would say that the planet, as far as people go, is in better shape for supporting humanity than it ever has been. I mean, think about it. We've made these major medical advances. Longevities are longer. We have all these great little gadgets like iPads and stuff. It's a pretty good time to be alive. So there's a lot of good things people have done, and I think it's really a mistake to forget that. Now, the flip side is we've also introduced some things that are putting us in peril of these tipping points, and those are the things right there, okay? So we've got five dangerous trends going on. We've got climate change. We're coming into an extinction crisis. We've transformed a lot of Earth's native lands into parking lots and cities and roads and things like that. There's an environmental contamination problem. And then, of course, that's all driven by human population growth and the amount that each person consumes. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. But it's those drivers that, in fact, are making us think about tipping points now. So tipping points. Let's think a little bit more about tipping points. I call those five dangerous trends, okay? And when you think about a trend isn't too scary because, you know, you start up here, and in this case, you know, consider this little ball, planet Earth, all right? And you put some sort of pressure on it, say climate change, whatever, and you start pushing, and you push and push and push, and you can kind of see it's going in a certain direction, so you have some sense that you can predict where you're going to end up. Apply a certain amount of force, you get to a certain state. That's not really the way nature works, as we know from boiling water, okay? What really happens is you apply a force and not much seems to happen. Think of heating up that water, not much seems to happen. Then all of a sudden, you reach some threshold, and all of a sudden, something big happens, and you're down here. And, you know, had you not have known this in advance, you would think, oh, we're going along just fine, okay? So that's one kind of a tipping point. And this kind of tipping point actually is exemplified by boiling water, because all you have to do is cool down the steam, and it turns back into water. So you can back up this one and fix things okay. There's another kind of tipping point, which is the one we're really worried about, and that's what mathematicians call things like fold bifurcations and hysteresis. But basically all it means is you push and push and push, not much seems to happen, and then you just drop all of a sudden to a place where you can't get back to where you came from. And the analogy there is right here, okay? An egg rolling off the table. You slant the table a little bit, the egg rolls, 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 gets to the edge of the table, falls off, and there's what you ended up with. So that's a change in state that you can't go back. You're in a new state, irreversible. That's the kind of thing that happens at these planetary state changes. Okay. So that's sort of the background concept of all this tipping point stuff. How close to the edge are we? That's what everybody really wants to know, right? Is it tomorrow? Well, we're probably pretty close. I mean, I think this illustration is a nice way to envision it, where right now the world we live in has a lot of this and a lot of this, but if we keep pushing, we're going to end up mainly over on that side and lose all of this stuff. Now, I just want to give you a sense of how close we are by making some comparisons between what happened at that last state change where we went from an ice age into the Holocene. Am I in your way here when I stand here? Okay. When we went from that last ice age into our present interglacial, and compare that with what's happened essentially in the last 50 years. And that gives you a sense of magnitude, okay? So we're starting here 100,000 years ago. And this graph moves us towards the present, so we end it about 1,000 years ago. And notice that two lines on here, this blue one goes along, doesn't do much until you get to a little before 10,000 years ago, and then all of a sudden, a sharp increase, okay? That's when human populations really began to expand to the point where we covered all the continents on the globe, or at least we were present on all the continents on the globe. Now look at that top red line. That shows you the number of big-bodied animal species. And by big-bodied, I mean animal species that, on average, are over 100 pounds in body weight. So you're a big animal species, okay? On average, humans are over 100 pounds in body weight. You start back here 100,000 years ago, and you can actually pull this way back to several millions of years ago, and there were about 350 species that were large-bodied animals. And as you go forward in time, you will note that as you increase human population sizes, you begin to drop down the number of other big-bodied species. And that actually makes sense when you think about it. There's only so much energy to go around on Earth in an ecological sense. So if there's more people, there's got to be less of something else. And that trade-off in big-body-sized animals is a pretty direct one. And then we start this rapid rise, and there's a big crash in other big-bodied animals. So we lost about half the big-bodied animals on Earth about the time that human population sizes started to really grow fast 10,000 years ago. And then that stabilized, and it carries through pretty much to today, although, as I'll tell you, we're starting to see some danger signs again. So that, you could think of that as a sign of one of these tipping points or ecological state shifts. Now let's think about that in a little bit more detail and think about population size on up to today. And what I've done here is not talk about number of species, but just the weight of all the big-bodied organisms on Earth, okay? So mega mammal biomass. So what we've done is we've come up with estimations of how many people were on Earth plus how many mammoths plus how many mastodons plus how many giant ground sloths, and we've run that through time, and that's what this green line is showing you, okay? So think of it as carrying capacity for big-bodied animals. And again, what you would see if you carried this back even farther is, for millions of years, carrying capacity for big-bodied animals was way down here. And then we hit that point where megafauna species crashed. That was that threshold effect as human population size were growing. That's this little dip right here. And then it starts to grow again. Carrying capacity for big-bodied animals begins to rise. And this, now the rise, though, is numbers of human bodies and numbers of cows and pigs and horses and sheep and our domestic animals. So those 150 species that went extinct aren't filling it back up. It's human bodies and our domestic stock. And it takes about 9,700 years to build back up to where it was to the pre-crash carrying capacity. And then look what happens. It just shoots off the charts. Well, if you are close enough to read the text by that dotted line, that's the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Okay? That's when we began to mine energy out of the ground, increase our knowledge on how to build things, and when we really began to take over the earth. And the point being is that now we are way up here, far, far above the normal carrying capacity of Earth. And without, you know, the technology that we have and the extra energy we mine out of the ground, which I'll talk about in a little bit, we would really be screwed because we'd have to drop back down to here. Okay, so now that's where we were a couple of years ago, 2008, I think. All right. So now, here's where we're going. So now we're 1950, projected out to 2100. And you can see that population, human population size has obviously continued to grow. We're up at 7 billion now. The projections we've got that are reasonable projections are the ones you see, the black line, this one in the yellow, and this black line down here are three reasonable scenarios depending on what happens. And the middle of the road one takes us up to about 10 billion people, and we'll be at 10 billion people by the year 2050. So how, and by any of these, we're going to be up to 9.5 billion people by the year 2050. And it just depends on what we do with birth rates and so on in countries that now are above replacement rate as to whether we go down or up, okay? Interestingly, this line is if we didn't change anything. If the birth rates, if fertility rates were the same as they've been over the past 10 years going into the future, by the year 2100, we would have, 27 billion people on Earth? Probably not going to happen, but that just shows you the power of exponential growth, okay? So all I'm trying to get across here is that as we went from that last glacial, interglacial transition, that state change, we saw a change in human population size. Now the change in human population size we're looking at is three orders of magnitude greater projected over just the next couple of decades. Okay, let's think about what having all those people on Earth does to the planet. And again, it's nice just to make a comparison with the past because that gives you a sense of how big it really is. So we go from an ice age when most of the northern hemisphere is covered with ice. You can see the extent of ice down here. And the Antarctic ice sheet is much greater. And then the ice melts, we get to our present landscape. In the course of that, we wholesale changed, or climate wholesale changed, about 30% of Earth's land surface, okay? Compare that with where we stand now. We've already changed over 40% of Earth's land surface from what it used to look like to things like this, agricultural land primarily, but also cities, towns, and other human constructs. So if you take 7 billion people and, you know, add up the number of acres, what it comes down to is each one of us, you live in a city, right? So what's your square footage in your house, apartment, whatever? Not very big. But really what you take is about 2 acres, okay, when you take into account how much of the footprint you have from buying food, you know, buying goods and everything it takes to really support you in the manner to which you are accustomed, comes out on average to about 2 acres per person. Actually, in the U.S., it's much more than that. In, you know, India, it's much less than that. But that's the world average. All right, so now think about that. We had 2 or 3 billion more people. All of a sudden, we're up over 50%. Pushing on 60% of transformed lands. What are those lands left that we could actually do something with? Well, rainforests, just the places we don't want to mess up for a lot of reasons. Okay, so obviously we can't do all that. We can't support ourselves without feeding ourselves. That all takes energy. And back in the good old days, we did just like every other animal and plant on earth. The only energy available for us ultimately was what came from sunshine hitting the earth, plants transforming that to sugars and starches, and then we would, you know, co-opt that up the food chain. So that wasn't enough for us. And I'll give you some numbers in a second here. In order to support that exponential rise that's taken us up to 7 billion people, we've begun to pull fossil sunshine, basically, out of the ground. So that's fossil fuels, all right, oil, coal, natural gas, and so on. And that's risen pretty much in direct proportion to our population growth. We need that energy to support us. So yellow is the population growth up to where we are right now. And then superimposed under that is the amount of energy we have produced that is in addition to the energy we take from other species. Now, the energy we take from other species in terms of this net primary productivity, people now co-opt 20 to 40% of all of the net primary productivity, all this natural energy that formerly was available for other species. That's not enough. We have to add all this from fossil fuels. And let me see, I can't remember if I... No, I didn't. Okay. So we have to add all this from fossil fuels. So exajoules, does exajoule mean anything to anybody? Probably not. But let me tell you what an exajoule is. So we use about, it's a measure of energy. We use right now somewhere in the neighborhood of total 700 and some exajoules per year to support humanity. The big earthquake in Japan a couple of years ago that, you know, destroyed the nuclear plants, caused the big tsunami, that was a little over one exajoule of energy. Okay, so that puts it in perspective. And we get the majority of that from fossil fuels, so a little over 450 from fossil fuels, okay, which, and we need it. I mean, you know, we'd all be, we wouldn't have 7 billion people if we didn't have that. So that brings us into our next issue, which is the climate disruption issue. Again, going back to that last tipping point, as we go from an ice-covered world to the world we know, we raise temperature about 5 degrees centigrade or Celsius, 9 degrees Fahrenheit. That was actually a, quote, natural global warming event. It was due to the natural variations in the Earth's orbit around the sun. It took about 1,600 years to complete that 5-degree shift. Okay, here's what's going on now. So this actually just came out a couple of weeks ago, kind of a cool graph. So we're going climate variation in terms of temperature variation over millions of years here. So that's what you would expect going back about 5 million years. And then a little more detail, so the scale shifts, and these are the glacial, interglacial times, so the past couple of million years, and you see we go from really cold to fairly warm. So we bounce back and forth a lot. Okay, and then we change scale again. And now this is the past 10,000 years through here. And you can see we're sort of bouncing around here in terms of temperature. And then we're into historic time, which is this red line. And now you can see we're still the early part of historic time. We're still, you know, about where we should be for an interglacial time. That's what these big spikes are. Now we start, here's the present, and you can see we're just getting above those spikes. And here are the projections for the future, okay? And what you gain from that is even in the best case scenario, which is this lowest line, we're going to be at a temperature that is higher than average temperature on Earth for the past millions of years. And actually, that's 14 million years. That's the best case. Worst case, we're going to be up here, which would be a higher temperature than Earth has seen for about 60 million years or so. So that's a totally different state for the Earth, and it's going there in as little as 200 years, which is really, really fast. All right, so those are a lot of the drivers. How's that going to affect the world? You know, when we think about the world, a lot of times you think about living things in the world, so that's where extinctions come in. And I've actually done a lot of work on extinctions and have thought about them a lot. But if you, who's heard of the sixth mass extinction? The sixth mass extinction, yeah. So we're in an extinction crisis right now. And I'll tell you a little bit more about that. But basically, rates of extinction of animals and plants have been fairly elevated for the past 100 to 500 years. And that's not even thinking about climate change, all right? So what's basically been driving it, and another point here is that all of these things I've been talking about are interrelated in terms of causing tipping points, but growing human population, you know, means we have to transform lands, which results in habitat loss. We have to fish out of the sea to put in the supermarket, exploitation of species at a faster rate than they can reproduce. So those are the things that have been driving the extinction crisis. Now people are starting to think about climate change as also contributing to that, and the problem really begins to look kind of severe. And that's why people are talking about the sixth mass extinction, okay? Actually, they were talking about the sixth mass extinction before climate change, but the reason it's called the sixth mass extinction is because in the past 550 million years, that is all of the time that multicellular life has been abundant on the planet, we've had only five times where biodiversity has taken a really major fast dip, okay? And these are the five times, those geologic time periods you had to memorize at some science class and forgot. Don't worry about them, you know, about but 400 and some million years ago, 300 and some, and so on. You can read those. And look at these numbers over here. These were times when between 75% and as much as over 90% of all the known species on Earth died out, okay? So these are big events. And that's one of the things that people are worried about these days, at least biologists who study this stuff. Now, here's the good news. It's not as bad as it seems. Because when you actually crank through the numbers, as we have, and say, all right, what's gone extinct? How bad are we? So I made this extinction-o-mometer to tell you how bad it is. So here's a true mass extinction, 75%. Okay, so we go from zero species extinct over here to 100% species extinct over here. So here's the big five mass extinctions, all of them over 75%. How far have we moved towards that? Well, if you know, these are mammals, birds, reptiles, amphibians, fish, corals, snails, clams, a certain kind of plant called cycads, and conifers, sharks, and shrimp and lobster type things. And if you take a look, most of what's actually gone extinct in the last 500 years, in terms of percentage, between 0 and 1%. So that's really, really good. Okay, we still have most of what we want out there to keep alive. Now, the bad news on this diagram is if you look at the species that are actually calculated to be in danger of extinction, that is, their populations have been much reduced. You know, the genetic variation is very low and so on. There are ways to quantify this. With mammals, 22% of mammal species are at risk, 14% of birds, 29% of reptiles, maybe up to 40% of amphibians. So I won't go through all those, but you can see if you think about what's at risk, then the numbers start to look a little bit more grim. Flip that back to the good side again, is we actually know that we can save species when they get down into that range by appropriate conservation efforts. Did somebody have a question back there? Insects are not actually very well understood in terms of extinction risk because people just haven't studied them in this way. But most, I would guess that insects are not going to suffer as much as everybody else for the reason that they have very short generation times, huge numbers of individuals with each population, so that they can, with each generation, so that they can actually evolve fairly quickly and keep pace with things. Not to say some insects aren't going extinct. In fact, some are at risk, particularly butterflies. Certain butterfly species are certainly at risk in the Bay Area, the checker spot bay. Bay Area checker spot butterfly has blinked out. So it happens for sure, but not in numbers that would show up on this graph. Yes. Yeah, and that's the other issue with the way climate is changing is that you get movement of disease vectors into places where they weren't previously. Yeah. Anyway, so now let's think about what's coming down the pike. And remember, when I say what's coming down the pike, I mean if we don't do anything differently, all right? Business as usual. And actually, one of the things I'm hoping that you're going to take home from this is that we can do things differently. So it's not a total gloom and doom story. But if we don't, people are already talking about it's too late for just a 2-degree rise. So let's think about that. 2 degrees. Okay, let's move into the future here, starting today. We go 200 years into the future. And this is the parts CO2 per million in the atmosphere. Don't worry too much about the numbers, but rising. And then on this side is the number of degrees that each of those PPMs would equate with. So what we want to do is hold it to 2 degrees. And if we reduce carbon emissions by 5.1% per year over this time, we would be able to do that, okay? If we don't, if we just do everything as we have been, this blue line is the trajectory. And you can see that by the year 2050, 40 years into the future, we would already be up close to, 4 degrees. And if we carry that out 80 years to 2100, we'd be up to almost 6 degrees, all right? So this is Celsius, yeah. So basically double it and think of Fahrenheit, all right? Okay, so the years 2050 and the years 2100. Lots of ways to think about that, okay? So you can think about it in years, or you can think about it in people time, okay? So 40 years from now, the kids that are born will just be grown up. Still younger than me, but grown up, okay? 80, 90 years, that's about a human lifetime. So this is stuff we're going to see happening. Now, what do those numbers really mean? You can also think about it in when was Earth last that warm? Okay, in the next 40 years, we could be at temperatures that we haven't seen for 14 million years. In the next 80 to 90 years, we could be at temperatures that we haven't seen for almost 40 million years. Right? How much change are we really talking about with plants and animals? Well, a picture is worth a thousand words, right? So this is a picture of Wyoming. And I choose Wyoming just because the fossil record is so good there that we can really reconstruct what things looked like. I'd love to be able to do this for the Bay Area, but we don't have the information. So, middle of Wyoming. Today, that's what it looks like. This desert, dry. 14 million years ago, this is what it looked like, a huge difference. 40 million years ago, it was a subtropical forest. Now, you know, the continents are in a little different position. I mean, I'm not saying we're going to go back to exactly these conditions, but the point being is we're looking at an awful lot of change that plants and animals have to deal with. So that's what they have to do, and they have to do it really, really fast. Okay. It's actually highly unlikely that a lot of plants and animals can adapt that fast or move that fast, the exception being things like insects or various kinds of rodents and so on. So that's what will inherit the Earth. People are probably going to do okay, but life is going to be a lot different. Here's sort of a very worst-case scenario. It's highly unlikely that before 2100 we would get to an increase of 12 degrees centigrade, but if we did, all these purplish areas would be places that were totally uninhabitable for mammals, humans including. You just couldn't lose heat fast enough, okay, to survive. Now, it is not at all out of the question that we would hit 7 degrees C, higher than we are. That happens, and you can read the text here. There would be small zones where metabolic heat dissipation would be impossible. That means people couldn't live there without air conditioning, period. And actually, it's a little lower than 7 degrees rise because that calculation is for somebody stark naked, standing in the shade, not moving, okay? Yeah. So Celsius, so basically not quite double it. So we're talking 12 degrees Celsius would be close to 20 degrees Fahrenheit, and 7 degrees Celsius is about 13, okay? So you know, the point being is this is stuff that will have effects on organisms on land. Now, another issue with climate change is as you put more CO2 in the atmosphere, there's a chemical reaction between the air and the water that ends up making the oceans more acid, okay? And we've already observed this over the last 30 or 40 years. This is happening. We're to the point now where in places in the Pacific Northwest, the waters are getting acid enough so that oysters on oyster farms will, the larval will start to grow, but then they just die. And what's happening is their metabolic pathways for shell formation and growth are totally disrupted because the water's too acid. And people have done several experiments on several other kinds of organisms now and said, okay, assuming we're moving into this warming world under different scenarios, what might we expect to see with ocean critters? And just all over the place, there's effects. These particular fish, severe organ damage, and you know that's just one example. They die because their livers and kidneys just don't work anymore. This is one of my I don't know if I'll call it my favorite scientific study, but it's kind of funny when you think about it, fish with learning disabilities. But how do you recognize a learning disability in a fish, right? But the way they recognize a learning disability in these particular fish is they can't recognize the predators who come to eat them anymore. So not a very good survival strategy. So again, the point being lots of effects. Coral reefs, there's a new study that came out just a couple of weeks ago. that basically says combination of warming water and more acid water will mean that there's a likelihood that by as early as 2050, there could be no more coral reefs. Now, coral reefs support about 25% of the fish in the sea, 9 to 12% of the fisheries we rely on. So this is a big deal, okay? These are things we don't really want to see happen. Okay, enough of that. Point being, we're pretty darn close to going over the edge here, okay? We're not there yet, but we sure could be in the next 30 years, 60 years. You know, sounds like maybe a long time off, but it actually doesn't sound so long off to me. If we just keep doing business as usual, okay? Now, so the big question that people always ask when I get to this point is it too late, okay? Let's take a breather. I don't think it is. Here's why. People are really, really clever. And we pull it out when you think that we can't. And, you know, it's getting to be, we're moving into football season here. So let's have a little football analogy here. If I can make this thing play. Oops, sorry, I didn't. There we go.
Whether you grew up in the suburbs of Boston, as Doug Flutie did in neighboring Natick, Massachusetts, or you were raised in Natick, Nebraska, chances are you remember the magical game-ending play that propelled Boston College over the defending national champion Miami Hurricanes more than 20 years ago. It was the day after Thanksgiving in 1984 on a national television stage from the Orange Bowl in Miami.
The ball went up and down the field, both teams scoring points left and right. And it was whoever had the ball last was going to win.
Doug is always thinking. You know, Doug comes up, and I'm on the sidelines with Jack Ricknell, and he says, Barry, tell Coach to let him score. I said, what do you mean, let him score? And he said it with a straight. He says, they're going to score anyways. They've been scoring all day. Just give me the ball back with enough time.
BC trailed the Canes 45-41.
Well, there were only 28 seconds left, so you can't put a legitimate drive together. So my thinking is, let's get the ball across midfield and throw one for the end zone.
Boston College held the ball with 6 seconds and 48 yards between them and the goal line.
I can remember being in the stands, and I got to admit, everybody in this section thought the game was over, packing up, walking out.
When we were in the huddle, I don't think if you asked anybody, they would have said, this game's over. I think if you asked everybody, they would say, hey, wait a minute, we got another play. We got another chance to score a touchdown. And everybody went to work.
We called it flood tip. We called Hail Mary in other places.
Three wide receivers out to the right.
My own twist on it is to hang on to the ball as long as I could. So that's why I scrambled out to the right. I got out on the corner and let it rip, and I just threw for the end zone.
Looks, uncorks a deep one for the end zone. Phelan is down there.
Oh, he got it!
Did he get it?
He got it!
Touchdown! 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 Touchdown, Boston College! He did it! He did it! Flutie did it! He got Phelan in the end zone! Touchdown!
I assumed the ball was incomplete, and all of a sudden I saw the official's arms.
So, okay. So you get the message, right? I mean, the game ain't over yet. It's looking pretty bad, but the game ain't over. And yeah. Well, you're right. You're right about that. You betcha. Yeah, I know where it's going. Yeah, and the reason I put that clip in there is basically just because, you know, there's a lot of gloom and doom about this stuff. Oh, it's over. We're screwed. And I think that's totally the wrong attitude. And the reason I think that's totally the wrong attitude is because, for one reason, people really are good at solving problems when they realize there's a problem. Okay, so when they want to. So So here's the other bit of encouraging stuff that for me as a scientist is starting to come out. You know, scientists have been talking about this stuff for 30 years. Finally, a couple of years ago, we wrote a paper about tipping points. And as a result of that, our governor, Jerry Brown, called me up. I was out running with my dogs. The phone rings, cold call. It says, "Yeah, time to talk to Governor Jerry Brown." Well, yeah, sure. So anyway, long story short, there are politicians out there, and not only politicians, but world leaders who are really interested in making a difference. And for the first time, they're starting to climb on board. So in the case of what's transpired with our state governor's office is we work with them, we being a group of scientists at Stanford, Berkeley, several other institutions, to develop this document that basically laid out these problems I just told you about. And it is, as it says, written in language that policymakers can understand and deal with. Governor Brown has actually been incredibly proactive in pushing this thing. He has now taken it to China and delivered it to President Xi. He's taken it to the White House, delivered it to Obama. He's given it to Secretary of State John Kerry. He's developed agreements with Mexico based on this thing. So this, and of course, President Obama for the first time now has come out in the past couple of months and actually started making movements on climate change. So my point being is the time is ripe at the political level to start making some differences. What's needed now is to really get the bottom-up support as well. So we're working on that. But let me go on here, and I want to talk about this more. But, you know, these sound like really big insoluble problems. And they are big problems. They are big problems. But, in fact, one of the things that this document that I just told you about points out in some pretty straightforward language is they're not insoluble. I mean, the population problem, that's all it takes. I mean, time and time again, it has been shown, educate women, raise economic standards, population fertility rates drop, okay? I had an interview on Fox News. They got wind of this paper and got a call from a Fox News reporter. And they loved it. I mean, it's like, who doesn't want better economic conditions for people, you know? I mean, I think these are things that happen. They can happen if people make them happen. The climate problem is a huge one. You know, there's a lot of political interests. There's a lot of economic interests. But the reality is, if we can get past those, as is starting just barely to happen, and I hope it happens all the way in time, technologically, we have the ability to stabilize greenhouse gas emissions and keep it at these lower levels, okay? And this is actually something that some people at Princeton came up with several years ago that's a little outdated now. But the basic deal is there's 15, 16, 17 different tacks we can take to reduce greenhouse gases having to do with, you know, how efficient we are, how we generate our power, technology such as carbon capture and storage, alternative energy systems. All we have to do is mix and match in appropriate ways, and we can actually crack this problem by 2050. There have been studies that show that, at least convincingly to me. So it's not something we can't do if we have the will. I mean, the technology really isn't an obstacle. Just think about it. You know, think about what we've done, what people have done. It took us, beginning of World War II, the United States did not have airplanes, basically. We had 3,000 airplanes. 5 years later, we had 300,000. We just tooled up, and it happened very fast, okay? 8 years from President Kennedy's initial speech to a person on the moon. And interesting backstory to this one is, any of you remember seeing the mission control when, you know, the pictures on TV when man landed on the moon and everybody jumped up? And anybody have any idea how, what the average age of those people in mission control was? 25, 26, something like that. So think about that. Those were 18-year-old kids when President Kennedy made that announcement. So we've got some incredible talent out there. You know, it took us 20 years to rebuild the devastation in Europe after World War II. I think what's happened in the past 30 years, we used to have all these stupid dial-up phones, okay, and only 310 million of them worldwide. Now we've got 6 billion cell phones, all right, and about 3 billion individual connections. In 50 years, we put dams on 60% of the world's big rivers. Now, whether or not you like dams, that's an incredible technological achievement. And enough highway, just in the United States, to encircle Earth twice in 50 years. So don't tell me we don't have the technological ability to do this stuff. Here's another thing that's happened in less than 50 years, okay? These are, the green is roads, the blue is shipping lanes, the white is airplane tracks, and the yellow is cities. So 50 years, that's what we've done. So, you know, don't tell me we have a technological problem we can't solve. In fact, the technology is in place. All we need to do is, I mean, we know the basics. We just need to do it. So other parts of the solutions, more efficient agriculture. You know, we've all heard about the Green Revolution, which actually was great in raising productivity in Western Europe and the USA. Not so great where we need it most, in Africa. All right, so Africa right now is the population problem. They're the country that is growing fastest. They're also the country that has the biggest food problems. But this sort of just gives you a flavor that we're going to put 3 billion more people on Earth. Most of those are going to be in places like Africa. We got to solve the food problem in places like Africa, and we have to solve it not by only making them dependent on people, but by increasing agricultural productivity in those places as much as we have in other places, and doing it in ways that is environmentally sound, which, again, is possible to do. And I don't have time to go into why that's possible to do, but it is. Another thing that is happening, okay, put a dollar value on nature. integrate it into our economic thinking. And again, this is happening. You know, one of the things that just, this is a book, actually. Read this book. It's great. It's by Mark Tursek. He's the CEO of the Nature Conservancy. He used to be an investment banker. But it's a nice overview of how you can do this and why it's important. But this is the one that blew me away, this Vision 2050 statement. Has anybody ever heard of this thing? This is put out by an organization called the World Business Council for Sustainable Development. If you just Google Vision 2050, you'll get it. And basically, these are the CEOs, and not representatives of the CEOs, the CEOs of most of the major companies you can think of, you know, Bank of America, Toyota, all the big guys. The whole bottom line of this thing is putting together a way to do business over the next 50 years with milestones that end up making a sustainable world for 9 billion people. And these are what they list as must-haves, okay? incorporating carbon ecosystem services and water into the marketplace structure, so trading in these things, doubling agricultural output without increasing pollution, basically, halting deforestation. So these are actually business plans that are being put in place. So point of all that, and I'm going to wind up here because it's getting late, is that, you know, there are people, smart people, talented people, not only scientists, but politicians, the business community, is really concerned about this stuff. And part of what's slowing it down is the word isn't out to the general public. So there's beginning to be much more of a top-down, you know, let's get this job done because it's important, but there's not quite enough bottom-up yet. And that's what really needs to happen, and, you know, where I'd be interested to get feedback from everybody how to make it happen. But let's just end on this note, you know. So what will it really take to do this? Well, we've done this stuff before, you know. We ended World War II. And we rebuilt afterwards. We accomplished the first green revolution. I mean, people were in danger of starving worldwide. We've recognized things analogous to the climate problem, the ozone hole, and we've put international agreements in place to reverse that. That's happening. It's been done. And what it takes is this, recognizing the need. So, you know, a lot of what I told you early on is there's a need. People, like I said, are incredibly talented. We'd have no shortage of individual initiative. Technologically, we're there. I mean, of course, we have to build on it, but we know what to do. This is a big one that we're still hurting on is cooperation, not only across the aisle, especially across the aisle, but internationally as well, and, you know, locally through nationally. So I think if we can actually get past this, the cooperation issue, I think we can do it. So I'm, you know, people always say, Are you pessimistic or optimistic? And I guess I have to say that I'm realistic. I think we can definitely do this. I think that we're poised on it. And as far as tipping points, we're either, here's the way the world's going to change in the next 50 years. We're either going to tip into all those bad things I said, or we're going to tip into a new way of doing business and a new way of doing politics where we make it a much, much better world than it is. So that's where we're poised.
At this point, I'd usually say, now it's time to ask questions, but it's time to come to an end. I think we'll ask maybe two questions or so. So,
Thank you. I have actually a comment and a question. First, I'm happy to see that CEOs of major corporations are interested in this problem, but I'd like to segue from that into a suggestion to people who want to do something political about this, which is that those CEOs, like all CEOs, at least in America, are constrained by the law, which says that they must maximize short-term profits, or they're violating their fiduciary duty to the shareholders. We all know what a problem that creates. So I'd like to suggest that to free up those CEOs who are of goodwill, people should agitate on the state level to change the laws authorizing the existence of corporations, to let corporations include the costs of externalities created by their activities, environmental degradation, et cetera, into the bottom line so they can do the right thing without violating their obligations as professional CEOs. That's the first thing. Second issue is I have a question, which is without going all the way to what James Lovelock says, which is we all better move to Siberia and the Hebrides right now because we're doomed, is anybody studying the issue of if things do not go as well as you hope, we ought to think about going where the effects of these things will be less drastic than other places? Where will human life be likely better able to survive in the future if we don't do what's required to be done?
Well, in terms of coping with issues from climate change. You know, places like parts of Canada are going to be much more pleasant in the future, I would say. Places, major cities in low-lying areas on coastlines, San Francisco, Sacramento, are going to be faced with some big problems. And not, you know, the problems will increase in direct or maybe even in exponential proportion to the amount climate actually changes. But given that the solutions there are anticipating and moving critical infrastructure and so on before the bad things happen.
All right, time for one last question.
Thank you. Great talk. I was just wondering, so often people pit jobs versus the environment, and I'm just wondering, like, if one were to be in a discussion with somebody about the Keystone Pipeline, and, you know, people might say, well, that pipeline's going to create X thousand of jobs. I mean, how can one respond? How does one grok those numbers? And
I think the conceptual way to respond to that is, you know, I think fossil fuels are dying technology. if you look at what's going on in the venture capital world in Silicon Valley, you know, if you look at what's going on in the World Bank, they're not even giving loans to countries to build coal plants anymore. So I think if you're really wanting to talk about job creation, alternative energy is the way to go. That those are growing industries that over the long term are going to be creating more and more jobs rather than the last gasp of 2,000 jobs on Keystone.
For the Keystones to be built, they actually assume all of those shale gas are going to be used. So that's why that they use that as an assumption. So if we do want to promote renewable energy, to say that we're actually not going to use all those shale gases, then it will be a great start.
Thank you very much, Professor Barnosky. For a great look at one of the big problems that we'll all be thinking about for the rest of our lives, I'm sure. I'm sorry that there wasn't a little bit longer for questions and answers. And also, the book is available. Heatstroke is available. There are only a few copies, but you can get a discount on buying the book over Amazon.com if you'd like instead. And the professor will sign the books. And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 110th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.